Welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and on the line with me is Rick Stinchfield. He is a volunteer at Capitol Reef National Park, but also author of the book, Capitol Reef National Park, The Complete Hiking and Touring Guide. And some of you may ask, well, why are we doing a hiking guide on the Zesty Garden? Well, there's a lot to do with the flora and fauna in the park that it's in this book. And since it's my favorite national park and I'm the host of the program, I thought I'm going to do this interview. So, Rick, thank you so much for joining me for doing this.
My pleasure, Brian.
Well, first off, I want to find out, how did you get to be a volunteer at the park?
Well, after I finished my career in higher ed a little early, my wife Lynn and I worked at the Grand Canyon for the concessioners for a couple years so that we could be there. And then after that, we decided that volunteering was probably a better way to go. And so we went to a wonderful website, volunteer.gov, which lists all the volunteer opportunities of all the federal land management agencies. And we had already chosen Utah because we hadn't spent much time there, and the Red Rocks had quite an appeal. And so we applied for a couple of positions, one over by Blanding and with the Forest Service, and then one with Capitol Reef. And Capitol Reef happened to be the one that responded first and best. And so that's how we wound up in the park.
What do you get to do as a volunteer?
Well, we serve during the shoulder seasons, that is to say primarily April and a little bit of March and May, and then again in October with a little bit of September and possibly into November. Those are times when the park staffing is somewhat low. The seasonal interpretive rangers have not yet come on board, and so we get to do that. And so we do just about what they do. That is to say, we spend quite a lot of time in the visitor center helping visitors decide what to do and where to go and where to hike. And then we do quite a few programs, evening programs and geology talks and Fremont culture talks. And my wife is going to open the schoolhouse this spring a couple days a week and so on. So we just pretty much do whatever the seasonal interpretive rangers do.
And what's your favorite part about volunteering at Capitol Reef?
Well, it's really twofold. It is just great fun to talk with people from around the world. And Capitol Reef, like all the Utah parks, gets a lot of international traffic. And it really is interesting to encounter and chat with those folks. And then, of course, being in Capitol Reef is really, really important. We spend most of our days off hiking, usually now in the backcountry, and it's a very large park and very complex, and we figure that before we die, we might get to 5 or 10% of it.
And so why write the book, then, if you've got another 80% to go? Are you just thinking of new books in the future with all this discovery you have yet to see?
Well, we've got another book in the works on South Central Utah that should be out this summer, surrounding Capitol Reef. I don't know that we'll do much more writing about Capitol Reef, but the general thing about the park is discovery, and so we just love to head into the backcountry and see what we can see.
Well, before we start talking about the book itself, why don't you describe the geography and the topography of Capitol Reef National Park? Because you start everywhere from high elevation all the way down to, I mean, it reaches almost to Flaming Gorge, to Lake Powell.
Right. Yeah, Capitol Reef is some 90 miles long. If you start at the north-northwest, about 8,800 feet, there's actually a bristlecone pine forest in the park up in that corner. And then it follows the Water Pocket Fold all the way down to Halls Creek Narrows, which is just above Lake Powell. It's dominated by the Water Pocket Fold, which is a monocline, probably the best known in the world, a single fold where the rocks to the west around Torrey are somewhat flat-lying, and the rocks to the east towards Hanksville and Caneville are somewhat flat-lying, And in between, they are tilted down to the east, such that the rocks on the west are about 7,000 feet. The rock layers are about 7,000 feet higher at Torrey than they are at Caneville. And that tilt in the rocks exposed by erosion is what gives the park a significant portion of its beauty and certainly its geological interest. And in terms of ecological niches, the changes in elevation along with many canyons and slope aspects and water courses and so forth provides a rich diversity of plant life as well.
There's not very many national parks that have that much diversity, especially in the topography and the geography. I remember going along the Burr Trail and stopping at going to the Strike Valley Overlook, and you can literally see these layers upon layers of how they might continue. I mean, it's like so many of them have eroded away, but you can see those layers and how the earth has warped them. And you just get this feeling of that's a ton of earth that and stone that is just it's gone. It's been eroded away.
Sure. And in fact, of course, there are rock layers in the park that were deposited below sea level in a shallow sea, and some of those layers are now many thousand, more than a mile above sea level. So you know that an awful lot of rock has been eroded away, and at the same time, an awful lot of that rock has been elevated due to tectonic forces. Most of the park's structures were due to major changes in the western United States when the Laramide orogeny occurred, and that's a compressional event which did the bending and did most of the elevation work. Now, of course, the western U.S., the Great Basin, is being stretched apart, and a whole different kind of topography emerges in the Basin and Range province where you have these long linear ranges.
Do I dare ask you if you have a favorite part of the park?
Sure. You know, it turns out that we didn't know this until we went to Capitol Reef, but we're canyon people. And so the really good canyons are very attractive to us, and we do tend to go back to those. Spring Canyon is certainly wonderful, and Sulphur Creek is very popular as it has paved road access, and so does Spring Canyon. But way down south, I would have to rate Halls Creek Narrows one of the top several natural wonders of Utah. It's a really extraordinary place, difficult to get to. Almost everybody has to backpack down there, but that's a really, really great place. And then, Cathedral Valley, less visited because of the difficulty of driving there, but eminently worthwhile. Totally different, which is very appealing as well. So, our favorite part of the park is the one that we're going to do tomorrow.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when I first was introduced to Capitol Reef, this would have been about 1991, and I had been asked by my journalism professor if I was interested in going down. She'd received a request from the park someone in the park to come down and document the park so that they could show their superiors in Washington what needs to be done in the park, all the different things that needed to be done to bring it up to what level they felt it should be. So I got to spend almost 3 weeks in the park traveling around, and I couldn't pick out a favorite spot because it was always my favorite spot was the one I happened to be in that particular day. And going
absolutely understandable. I think that we get so many visitors now that we see every spring and again every fall. They just can't stop themselves from coming back because there's so much new to see.
Well, let's talk about the book. Why did you decide to put this together?
Well, it was basically the Natural History Association. We had a couple of small publications that described the trails. But the Natural History Association, headed by Shirley Torgerson, wanted to actually have a good trail book. And they The Natural History Association, as you probably know, any profits from the bookstore and from sales at the Gifford House go to the park. And in part, some of those monies had gone to provide our housing when Lynn and I were there volunteering. And so we felt that that would be a really good way to kind of pay the Natural History Association back if we did the book for them. And so they kind of sponsored it, and we did it, and it seems to have worked out pretty well.
Now, should you have a detailed map of the trail, or is it what you have in the book enough?
The feedback that we have, we didn't put detailed maps in, and the feedback that we've gotten is that most people are quite comfortable with the descriptions in the book. Certainly for the front country trails, those trails that are built and maintained, I don't think anybody really needs a map. For some of the backcountry routes, and the book has a lot of those, and they're fairly long, those backcountry routes, by virtue of being quasi-official routes of the park, are usually marked in by cairns or are obvious enough that people can find their way without too much trouble. On the other hand, my theory is you can never have enough maps, and it's always good to have the relevant topographic map or perhaps the Trails Illustrated map of the park now, which has been updated and is quite good.
And on most of these, you do have a map, a little broader-looking map that tells you where in the park that particular hike is and approximately how much of it that it would take up. For instance, I'm looking at one here that shows where Burl Wash is and the Cottonwood Wash and Sheets Gulch and the three related hikes that go along with that.
Right, and those the description in there on how to find the trailhead should be quite sufficient for people. Those particular hikes are up canyons. You just happen to pick out, I would say, three more favorites there. We do love slot canyons, and Utah slot canyons are not confined to the Escalante region or the San Rafael Swell. We've got a couple of really good ones in the park, Burro Wash and Cottonwood. Of course, before anybody were to do those, they'd need to stop at the visitor center and get updated information. Cottonwood Wash, we didn't have a chance to confirm this before we left in the fall, but Cottonwood Wash suffered from the flooding in September of last fall and may not be as accessible as it sounds in the book. So updated information is always a really good thing.
I was going to say, going to the park headquarters and asking specific questions is always the first thing to do once you get to the park. As you say, things change, and that's what the park is all about, because you have a lot of flooding going on, especially in the monsoonal months like July and August, that can completely change a trail around.
Yes, and that's why we really like late April and almost the entire month of October and even some of late September. Generally, the weather is pretty nearly perfect then. It's not too warm. It's generally bug-free. In late April, the flowers, especially down south, if we've had a good rainy spring and fall, can be really fabulous. And in October, the colors in the canyons surprise a lot of our visitors from New England who are used to great fall displays, but are quite taken with what they can see in the canyons. And then late October, of course, the cottonwoods flame out in the gold, and that's when most of the professional photographers come to the park.
Well, something that you can do in Capitol Reef, it's got the scenic drive, so you can go through the middle of the park and take the scenic drive south, but I highly recommend picking a hike and getting out, and there are some very simple hikes. Of course, there are many more difficult hikes, but this I would recommend this book. I love having this book. It's called Capitol Reef National Park, The Complete Hiking and Touring Guide, Text and Photography by Rick Stinchfield. And we'll have information on our website about how you can purchase this book. But why don't you go ahead and give that right now as well?
The way to purchase the book right now is to go online, or either come to the park, to the bookstore in the visitor center, or go online to capitalreefnha.org. And right there on the front page, you can simply click on the icon of, that is the cover of the book, and go through the steps there, and they will send it right to you right away.
Now, let's, if you're comfortable doing this, let's just go through a couple of these hikes so the people get
sure.
some kind of an idea of what they'll see. So start out with an easy hike. You're not a hiking type person, but are interested in seeing a little bit more of the park other than just driving through it. So what would be the hike that you would choose to do?
Well, there are really two that almost anybody can do. They're both great for families, and those are the two primary canyon hikes, Grand Wash and Capitol Gorge. Capitol Gorge would be the one that people that are really interested in history might take, because there are wonderful panels of inscriptions of early pioneers, explorers, prospectors who came through Capitol Gorge in the late 1800s. But my choice would probably be Grand Wash, especially if you happen to have two cars. You could station one on Highway 24 and then drive down the scenic drive and down the very short graded dirt road to the trailhead, and then simply walk through the canyon. On both ends, the canyon is quite impressive and very pretty. In the middle, it is absolutely spectacular, narrows to 15 to 20 feet wide and several hundred feet deep, makes a nice S-shaped bend there, really quite impressive. So as far as easy, and both of those canyons are largely flat. If you walked down Grand Wash through the narrows and then came back, if you only had one car, it's very, very, very gently uphill on the return. So that would be kind of the beginner's hike.
And what I like about what you have here in the book, it tells you the first thing is length. So this one is 2.5 miles or 4 kilometers from point to point. It tells you how much elevation gain there might be. The difficulty of the hike is easy. Special conditions, of course, pretty much anywhere in the park, but especially here, flash flood danger. Reasons to hike, impressive and deep narrows, easy walk. Solitude factor can be low depending on type of the year because of it's one of the three most popular hikes in the park. And, of course, so we can tie this into the Zesty Garden, plants of interest, Apache plume, and cliff rose. And Apache plume, can you talk a little bit about the flower and why it's so interesting?
Sure. And Apache plume and cliff rose, if they're not in bloom, are a little hard for quite a lot of people to tell apart. They both have very small, leathery, dissected leaves. Somewhat, they generally grow in washes. Cliff rose can get up a little higher. Apache plume does like the banks of the washes. Apache plume's flower is fairly large, white, a good rose kind of flower. The thing about Apache plume is that the seed plume, which forms after flowering, and it can flower almost any time during the summer. When it rains, Apache plume is likely to set out a bloom. But once it has flowered, a beautiful pink seed plume forms, and those plumes can be very persistent and last all winter, which makes identifying Apache plume a little bit easier in relationship to cliff rose. Both of them have white flowers generally, but the Apache plume, whereas cliff rose will often emerge from a single stem, Apache plume will form these large banks of plants, bushes and shrubs along the edges of washes. And so their habit is a little bit different, and you can sometimes tell them apart that way.
And you do have pictures of them, so you can see what the flower looks like and what the plant itself looks like. And these are color photographs, so they're really quite helpful. You've got best time to hike is midday for the light in the narrows, and then what the trailhead access is like, and then just a brief description of the hike itself. So very helpful. And then a map to show where in the park that particular hike is, and then approximately, you know, how long that can take to hike. Of course, it depends on how fast you're going.
Right. And people who are interested in plants or Grand Wash and Capitol Gorge, both are great places to see our small herd of bighorn sheep if you're very, very lucky. You know, and if generally the people who are more observant tend to be luckier. So it can take quite a while to wander through either canyon, or you can do it fairly quickly.
I wanted to ask about the Sulphur Creek route because I haven't done it, but I wanted to take my wife and daughter and my son. So my son, he's the youngest, he would be 12. Is this where you would go exploring?
Sulphur Creek is extraordinarily popular with families. Sometimes that causes us a little worry in the park because that is not what we would call a walk in the park. There's some definite scrambling involved, depending on how you classify these things. If people know the classification, it's surely class 3. Some people might call a couple of the down climbs class 4, which means you're using your hands and feet and you're kind of spidering your way down. And I say down because it's a point-to-point hike. Most people start near the Chimney Rock trailhead and go down a dry wash a mile and a half or so to Sulphur Creek, and then down Sulphur Creek to the visitor center. Now, Sulphur Creek is live. It flows all year. Terrible place to be during a flash flood. I mean, that would be the last place you'd want to be aside from one of the slot canyons. So you have to be careful of that, especially in the summer. In cooler months, it can be downright cool there. You may have to splash around. We have done Sulphur Creek when we had to swim, and we've done Sulphur Creek when the deepest part was ankle deep for a short distance. So again, stopping at the visitor center is a real good idea. It's more than 5 miles point to point, obviously downhill. Very pleasant walk until the first down climb. And these down climbs are on the order of 15 to 20 vertical feet, probably. And then you are in a very tight canyon. It's quite spectacular. There are places where the stream fills the canyon wall to wall. There are undercuts. The color at almost any time of the day is very good in there. It's a good thing to do during the day because for light for photography, you want the sun up fairly high so you don't have it too contrasty. A great adventure for people, and as I say, very, very popular for families. We have huge family groups doing it, but younger children, your 12-year-old won't have any trouble doing it on his own, I suspect, but much younger children will need help with the little down climbs.
So you're not going to need to have rappelling gear, it sounds like.
No. People who are inexperienced completely in any kind of canyoneering, I suppose they might feel more comfortable if they had an experienced member who had a short rope to help them down. But in general, the vast, vast, vast majority of groups do not use any aid there.
What kind of shoes would you wear?
That's a really good question. When we see people doing it in flip-flops and sneakers, that's really not a good idea because these down climbs require some pretty sturdy footwear. And so when I do it and if I go with a group and make sure that everybody has good climbing boots to go down the down climbs, but it is absolutely the case you're going to be, it's not absolutely, it's almost surely you're going to be in the water. So we just simply take along a pair of water shoes or, you know, old sneakers would do fine. We just stick them in our pack. And when we get to the point where we need to do a little bit of wading, take off the boots, put those on, and we're good to go.
And what would you see plant-wise along this hike? Cottonwoods, I would imagine?
There are a few cottonwoods. In the upper part in the dry wash to get down to Sulphur Creek, it's good typical PJ, pinions and junipers. and the typical bank plants that are there. You might see an Apache plume and a cliff rose and that sort of thing. In the canyon, just about any of our forbs are likely to show up. Early on, of course, there'll be evening primroses, lots of Indian paintbrush and that sort of thing. So a pretty wide variety of plants.
Okay. Let's take a look at a medium difficulty hike.
Yeah. Again, there are two that we generally recommend for people if they come in without too much knowledge of the park. One would be Cassidy Arch, just under 4 miles round trip and I think 670 feet of vertical or so. That's a good one. But if you're interested in the big view, the really good, huge view as opposed to the canyons, then we generally recommend Rim Overlook. Or for vigorous hikers who need a workout too, Navajo Knobs, which has a truly extraordinary view. But Rim Overlook will do. You start out at the Hickman Bridge trailhead, which I should let people know will be closed until April 2nd. We had a huge rock fall there last spring, and they're still working to clean that up, so the crew is there. But after April 2nd, we expect that trail to be open again, and it's a very popular trail just to Hickman Bridge. But for Rim Overlook, you start out on that trail, go 0.3 miles, and then the trail to Rim Overlook is at a signed junction. It's a pretty good climb, 1,100 feet in a couple of miles, a little more than a couple of miles. But the view from Rim Overlook is extraordinary. It is literally straight down onto the schoolhouse in Fruta, and then south all the way down the fold, west up to Boulder Top, Boulder Mountain, and then east out over the knobs and turrets of the Navajo sandstone. It's really quite an extraordinary place. That's one where I think it's a good idea to maybe go in the afternoon when the sun comes around to the west and you look to the east. Those Navajo domes are creating all kinds of contrasty shadows, and it's really a very, very interesting place to be.
Well, and as I'm looking through and reading some of the various hikes, I love how you weave into it not just where the hike will go, but what you're seeing while you're on the hike, in addition to the different plants. You're talking about the geology that goes along with it.
Yeah, Lynn and I both have backgrounds in geology, and so, of course, that's something that's near and dear to our heart. And really, if you were to take a beginning geology course or maybe a sophomore sedimentation course field trip any place in the world, I don't know that you could do much better than Capitol Reef. The geology is exposed. There's not a lot of ground cover, of course. The fold exposes 17 different formations within about maybe 15 air miles. It's just amazing what you can see. And so, yes, and for each hike, we've tried to include a little bit of that. And in the back, there's a one-page listing, or maybe two pages, of which hikes will show you which of the geologic formations in the park.
And that's the helpful part. So, like, you've got these two pages, best hikes or drives to view geological formations, and it just gives you that information. There's a lot of cross-referencing that goes on from one to the next, and there's you even have hikes by type, canyons versus slots versus the sweeping views or desert hikes or natural bridges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that should be handy if people are only going to be in the park for a day or so and they have a particular affinity for any one of those things. They can just go back there, and that helps them limit their choice set.
So if you had one hike and you could spend a couple of days doing it, and it's one of the more difficult hikes, which one would that be?
Well, the one I would do would be Halls Creek, but there are some pretty serious caveats to that, Brian. In my opinion, to enjoy it, it's a 3-day backpack, a day to go from the trailhead at Halls Creek Overlook down to the northern end northwestern end of the Narrows. And then the payoff day to hike over Halls Creek Divide and then come back through the Narrows, which about 3 miles of truly incredible canyon, water all the way. You're wading in the water for most of those 3 miles. There are crayfish and actual fish in the water. There are little hanging gardens, lots of maidenhair ferns and monkey flowers and that sort of thing. It's both stark and lush at the same time. And those 3 miles, you know, even if you tried to do them fast, would take several hours, but there's no reason to do that because after you come out, you'd be right back at your camp and ready to go. The caveats are it's really no place to be when it's hot because it's low. It's down towards Lake Powell. And the bugs are a problem in May and maybe into June. It's obviously no place to be during the monsoon season. And in the spring right now, the water can be pretty cold. You're going to be in the water much of a day. That can take a toll. So you need to be well prepared for that. You don't know until you do it, and we don't have people go down there very often to report. So you don't know how deep the water is going to be. Most people report, and when we've done it, it's been about waist deep at its deepest point and knee deep for most of it. So cool water is a problem. We like the last week in September, first week in October as a general rule. To do that, it's the temperatures are still warm enough to enjoy it. The water by then, of course, is quite warm. The flowers, the monkey flowers and so on, may still be in bloom, especially the last couple of weeks in September. And the monsoons should be pretty much over. But that's one where you really pay attention to what the National Weather Service has to say.
Fred Child, who's host of Performance Today, a program that we carry, he came to do a dinner for us in the Torrey area a couple of years ago. And he did the Halls Creek Narrows with his girlfriend and just absolutely loved it. I mean, they spent several days doing the hike. And every time we talk to Fred, he brings how much he enjoyed doing that particular hike.
I actually wrote the backcountry permit for Fred, and we should remind people then for overnight trips in the park, you do need a backcountry permit. It's free. You get it at the visitor center, and unlike most of the national parks, the popular national parks, any place in the country and in Utah, in Capitol Reef, you are not confined to prescribed campsites. There's a lot of freedom in Capitol Reef because we don't have the kind of hiking pressures that some of the other parks do. And so it's a very, very easy process. But we sure do want people to come get those permits because in the unlikely event that they do have an accident or lose their way, we need to know about where they are.
What would you say is your favorite or most unusual plant that someone might see in the park?
Oh, that's a toughie. I'm quite enamored of round-leaf milkweed, Asclepias rotundifolia, which is very pretty, and it's around a lot. You're going to have to look for that, but you can find it in a lot of places in the park. There's another variety of milkweed, Ruthii, which is quite rare. That's in the extreme eastern part of the park up in towards Cathedral Valley. You know, most people are going to be blown away in a good year by Utah penstemon, the absolutely uniquely colored pink penstemon as opposed to red. Prince's plume, of course, is a beautiful plant. It's often down in the southern part of the park. I should say the cacti are amazing. Starting with claret cup early, probably early in April. This might be a good year for cactus because of all the rains in the fall. The park is home to a very large number of endemic species, to say nothing of some that are threatened or endangered. If a person is knowledgeable about real rarities, Capitol Reef is a really good place to go. We don't generally broadcast where those plants are for obvious reasons, but in general, you can find quite a few plants that are endemic to that part of Utah, a few that are endemic to the park, and have a lot of fun doing that. There's a gilia, Rabbit Valley gilia, that's quite rare, but observant people can find Rabbit Valley gilia right next to the road in a couple of places, and the same for McGuire's daisy, which used to be listed, no longer listed, but fairly common, and if you know what you're looking for, sometimes you can find these plants.
Well, and there is a good reason why you should take a couple of days instead of just, don't zoom through the park and try to do something real quick. Take a couple of days so you can take the time to really observe and see what's there for you to see.
Yes, and to visit, you know, several different ecological niches, because the you know, what grows on the north-facing wall of a canyon is way different than what grows on the south-facing wall, and what's up in the north end is totally different than the black brush desert in the south end. So, yeah, there's a lot of places to see, you know, if you are interested in the flora, I think Capitol Reef is a fabulous place to go. And even in a relatively dry year, you're going to find individual members of a large number of species, even if you're not seeing great sweeps of color that you would in a wet year.
I know a couple of years ago, I took my wife on a hike just walking down Pleasant Creek, and I had my bird book with me, my Sibley field guide, and boy, I was picking up different species that I had not seen before, because they're using that perennial stream as a way to get through this obstacle of the water pocket fold. And it's just, it was amazing to me. We had to keep stopping because I was pulling the binoculars out looking through the book. And the hike itself wasn't very long as far as the length, but we spent several hours there because of all there was to see.
Yeah, and we have been in Pleasant Creek in the spring when, in a good year, when the globe mallows and the scorpion weed and all their attendant, other flowers that are there too, are just incredibly colorful. And another fabulous time for Pleasant Creek is that October 15th to 25th window when all those cottonwoods are gold. Pleasant Creek, a wonderful hike with there's not an official trail there, but there's a pretty good use trail or social trail, and we do kind of hope that people will stay on that so that keep resource damage to a minimum.
Well, we've been talking with Rick Stinchfield. He's the author of text and photography of the book Capitol Reef National Park, The Complete Hiking and Touring Guide. I look in the back here, and I'm reminded of how much information this book really has, because you're talking about the geology of the park, the flora, the public lands, the Fremont culture, the people that used to live there, the history of Fruta. So there's so much involved with this book. And why don't you once again tell our audience how they can get a copy of Capitol Reef National Park, The Complete Hiking and Touring Guide.
The way that they can do that now is either to visit the park and pick it up at the bookstore in the visitor center, or before they come, so they have a chance to look it over, just go online to CapitolReefNHA.org. And when that website pops up, that's the Natural History Association's website. The book will be right there. You can just click on that and follow several easy steps, and it'll be on its way to you that day.
Great. Rick, thank you for taking the time to discuss your book.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Brian. And we hope that folks will come see us at Capitol Reef right now. Next month, all the fruit trees are in bloom. Awfully good time.
Well, and that's a good question. When's the best time to see all the flowers? Is it later in April, or does it just depend on what you want to see?
You know, a very cool spring can put the peak of the flower bloom into May. A relatively mild spring, maybe what we're having now, I don't know. It's quite possible the peak bloom will be maybe the last week in April. For the fruit trees in Fruta, we have 3,000 fruit trees of every variety you can imagine. The apricots are in full bloom now and will be actually done soon. It looks like we may have escaped a frost this year, which would be good for an apricot crop. But the other trees, apples, will bloom, apples and pears, will bloom mostly into probably into May, most of April. Peaches as well. Peaches go pretty quickly, but they're very pretty.
Rick, thanks again for joining me today on the Zesty Garden.
Oh, you're welcome, Brian.
You've been listening to the Zesty Garden. I've been interviewing Rick Stinchfield. He's author with the text and photography of Capitol Reef National Park, the complete hiking and touring guide. He's joined me on the line from Pagosa Springs, Colorado. He's also a volunteer at Capitol Reef National Park. If somebody wants to volunteer, where do they go for information? Just at the park headquarters?
They could do that. They can email the park in general, and I'm not positive right now who's the volunteer coordinator. But if all federal agencies have their listings, their formal listings on volunteer.gov, they're set up by state. Great place to go if you want to volunteer for any land management agency.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rick.
Okay.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Coming up next is Petals and Prose with Helen Cannon.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and also with Spring Fever, I've decided. I want the next few times when I have a chance to talk with you to talk about some of the spring flowers. Last time, I even persuaded my husband to come and sing a song about daffodils, and I thought I'd do just a little bit more about daffodils today. This is from an essay by Charles Kuralt, who was a distinguished journalist for more than 30 years, the host of CBS News Sunday Morning. He was an inveterate traveler. He logged more than 1 million miles in the course of his life and his work for CBS. And this is his essay called A Change of Plans. I have a dear friend, Granville Hall, who raises daffodils in Gloucester, Virginia. I feel lucky if I see him once every 10 years, but he is the sort of man who doesn't let time and distance impede friendship. Nearly every summer, he sends me a box of daffodil bulbs, old standbys and new hybrids, and I dutifully plant them in the fall in a grove of Connecticut maple trees, which I've come to think of as Granville's woods. I look forward to the October ritual. I take a sturdy bulb planter and a big bag of the right kind of fertilizer from the shed and twist the 12-month stiffness out of my gardening gloves and spend a day or two filling patches of ground where I haven't planted Granville's bulbs in years past. There's a satisfaction in this. The bulbs don't need much attention from year to year, and the forest floor has become a pretty good daffodil show in the spring. But I've not always been able to be there in the spring to enjoy it. One year, CBS News sent me to Moscow in April for a summit conference, and another year to Beijing in the peak of daffodil weeks. One of the frustrations of my job was not being able to say, "I'm sorry, I can't cover this cosmic event on the other side of the world because I have to go watch my daffodils bloom." Well, now I didn't have a job anymore. I was free to go watch my daffodils bloom, which, come to think of it, is everybody's reason for retiring, to take time to smell the flowers. And here I was, still driven by this immutable, rambling habit of mine, planning, on my own, to be on the other side of the continent in daffodil season. Suddenly, the Monterey Peninsula didn't seem quite so crucial to my perfect year. In a perfect year, you ought to be free to change your mind. Besides, Granville Hall had paid me considerable compliment the previous fall into his annual shipment of daffodil bulbs, large yellow trumpets and double whites, hybrids, each labeled by name. He had tucked a paper bag sealed with staples containing two bulbs he obviously meant to be special. When I opened the bag, a label fell out. It said, "Narcissus Charles Kuralt." It took me a few minutes to realize it wasn't a joke. Granville had named a daffodil for me. In a letter which came later, he said that in all his years of breeding daffodils, this was the first cultivar he had ever registered. He sent along the certificate from the Royal Horticultural Society. He said he had raised the bulb from seed and named it in honor of my impending retirement. In all the world, he said, there now existed just 3 Charles Kuralt daffodil bulbs. He wanted me to have 2 of them. I had planted those 2 bulbs with special care in a pretty place on a slope above the mill pond. They had been gathering strength all winter. I calculated that their first shoots would appear toward the end of March, and they should bloom in the 3rd or 4th week of April. Narcissus, you know, was a youth who pined away in love for his own image in a pool of water and turned into a flower. Now Granville Hall had turned me into a flower. A wave of narcissism washed over me. I wanted to see myself as a daffodil. I decided Monterey Bay would still be there next year. It was a lovely April in New York. I had acquired a writing room atop a building in Midtown Manhattan and fixed it up with mahogany shelves and cabinets, shutters for the windows, and oriental rugs on the floor. I installed the desk and chair I bought in New Orleans and arranged everything to resemble the library of a very small and down-at-the-heels men's club, just the effect I wanted. All the time, I was waiting for my daffodil to bloom. I knew a lot of hard work and good luck went into breeding a new daffodil, but I had no idea how much time and patience went into it until I asked Granville to tell me the details. He responded with a letter from Gloucester. That's when I found out about the New Zealand butterfly. Most daffodil varieties on file in the International Daffodil Registrar in London are the result of careful hybridizing, applying the pollen of one showstopper bloom to the stigma of another, and keeping careful records of this cross-pollination. For 5 or 6 years, it takes for the tiny seed to become a blooming bulb. But as a flower, my own birth was unplanned. As we used to say down in home in North Carolina, I was a love child. Granville wrote, I wish I could tell you that Narcissus Charles Kuralt is the product of years of brilliant and strategic cross-pollination by a master of the trade. Well, tain't so. Your lovely namesake was conceived by a butterfly or ant or spider or naive bee or by the wind among the plantings of Phil Phillips in New Zealand. The happy accident occurred in November 1983. So, as a flower, I was the child of an unnamed mother and an unknown father, conceived in New Zealand, bred in Tidewater, Virginia, and now resident of Connecticut. I was dying to know what I looked like. The possibilities, of course, were astronomical. Granville had told me that professional breeders who cross daffodil genes don't always or even usually obtain a pretty flower. So what could a butterfly or ant or bee or spider have accomplished by chance? All I had to go on was a copy of Granville's application to the Royal Horticultural Society. Seed parent unknown. Pollen parent unknown. This sounded promising. I let my imagination wander. There was a new flower in the world. Perhaps all who saw it would be awestruck and wish to have it for themselves. I didn't expect daffodil mania to sweep the world like the tulip speculation of 1634. That year, a Dutch collector traded 12 sheep, 8 pigs, 4 oxen, a bed, a suit of clothes, and 1,000 pounds of cheese for a single viceroy tulip bulb. But I had heard of higher prices for daffodils. 3 bulbs of a new variety, Will Scarlet, changed in the hands of $18.99 for nearly $1,000. A now abundant daffodil named Fortune sold for $75 a bulb when it was first introduced in 1923, and even King Alfred, which is now sold by the hundreds of tons each year and is the only daffodil name most people recognize, brought $20 or $30 a bulb when it was a new variety. Maybe my namesake daffodil, which I was about to see for the first time, would become internationally coveted and make Granville Hall a rich man. Then I learned from Granville that there are more than 20,000 named daffodils and that another couple of hundred are added to the international registry each year. This fact dimmed my dreams of fortune, but it didn't dim the romance. It pleased me to think of these 2 bulbs in Connecticut giving forth their first pale green spikes to the sunshine. They were descendants of the first daffodils to make their way to Europe from Turkey in the Middle Ages. And of Wordsworth's daffodils in that poem I had to memorize in the sixth grade. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. Well, it's hard for other people to understand, those of us who love planting. But it's a passion that gives much satisfaction. And so Charles Corralt ends by saying, "Plucks," after he saw his beautiful narcissus bulb, he said, "Plucks tarnish, scrolls fade, but those daffodil bulbs will divide and multiply. Within a year or two, I'll be able to give a couple of bulbs to each of my daughters. If they plant them and care for them, those will divide in turn and yield bulbs for my grandchildren. With a little luck, the flower named Charles Corralt will appear from the earth to bloom in the spring long years after the man of the same name is gone." I guess that's not exactly immortality, but it's as close as I will ever get. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.